for Monday, April 27th. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here today. With that, I'm going to first open at the request of the chair from Judiciary, because he has to get down to chair his committee. I'm going to first open a public hearing on House Bill 3547. Erin, will you please describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3547 requires member of Legislative Assembly to file a statement of paid political activity with Secretary of State if member or immediate family member of the member serves as a paid candidate consultant, defines paid candidate campaign consultant, requires member to file a supplemental statement every 7 days for a period of time individual qualifies as a paid candidate consultant, imposes a fine of $50 per day, up to $5,000 for each day a required statement is either filed late or filed with incomplete information. There is an emergency clause on the measure, has a no revenue, and does not have a fiscal impact statement yet issued.
Who would like to start? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jeff Barker, House District 28. Thank you, committee. Just briefly, and as you say, I'm on my way to Judiciary Committee. This bill is about transparency, just trying to have things on the open so it lets everybody know where income's coming from and adverts the perception of a conflict of interest or an actual conflict of interest. I would note that while Representative Buehler told me a lot of this stuff was, he felt was political theater, but he made a pretty good point in an email he sent out saying he was shocked by the what he considered a downplay in ethics reform of any criticism of that. And he says, public trust has been lost, and we need to put in place stronger protections to ensure things never happen again. And this is looking down the future, Madam Chair. This is saying we don't know who's going to be elected in the future, but we want to be sure that whoever is, if they're involved in political campaigns, they just report it just so it's on the open so everybody can see it.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vic Gilliam, State Representative from Silverton. That was a pretty good kickoff. I would just simply add, I have expressed a couple of times, certainly in our caucus and on the floor, how I hope that in our rush to raise the bar on ethical considerations in Oregon State politics and Oregon State government, that we take a close look at our own branch of government first. This is an example of a bill I'm happy to put my name on that I would support in this session, unlike those aimed at, and rightly so, aimed at other branches of government, particularly when they're under investigation, a federal investigation. I will not support those bills. And I'm sure there are differences of opinion on this committee and other places, but I won't. This is the kind of bill that I think focuses on our own branch and does something about not only the 80 of us, oh wait, there's 90 of us, the 90 of us who serve, but also those that will come after us. So I think I welcome a hearty discussion about I should say, sharpening the line between political activity and serving in the Oregon legislature. It can become blurry. These are complex times in politics, and I believe people, voters, individuals in our constituencies deserve to know if, in fact, we as legislators, public servants, are also involved in political consulting, when and how much and who in our family and so forth and so on. So I look forward to a discussion by the committee and others that will come and testify. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members of the committee, any questions, comments? I do want to call attention, want to thank Representative Parrish, included for us, I don't know if it's on OLIS, but an Oregon Live story talking about how the House Democratic Caucus took a vote to pay the caucus leader during the campaign season, not during session. And Representative Gilliam, I want to thank you, because when you put this bill in, As you said, you spoke to your caucus. You came to me and said, look, this would also cover you. And we have made the decision that when we go into the campaign season, we will file on ORSTAR. And I'm happy to be transparent about, as the caucus leader, about being paid for that job. To be clear, I don't get paid any more or less depending on how many candidates I work with, how many mail pieces are put out, what job is done. And as a caucus leader, much like my Republican colleague, our jobs are in the interim to work on elections. That's the expectation. That is the job. And I personally do not think that I should get state funding to do campaign work. But to be clear, we will file on ORSTAR from Future PAC going forward, but we don't. I don't receive that payment during the legislative session, nor would any future caucus leaders. With that, all right. Any other comments? Thank you.
Very much.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I just gave you a pay raise. Thank you.
Same pay.
I thought the speaker gets a little more.
A little more.
I just gave you a pay raise and a title raise. For the record, Madam Chair, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, here on House Bill 3547, and I hope that the Dash 2 amendments, which hopefully might be on OLIS, so just want to say I support the bill. There are some challenges with the underlying bill as it's written, and I want to describe those to you. There is a constitutional question as it's written, and I think that the Dash 2 amendments, if you look, you should also have the legal opinion from our LC about how the Dash 2s maybe get us there, and I would be happy to bring up legislative counsel, I think, is in the room, who might be able to better address those questions, as I just literally got this morning and haven't had a chance to fully engage with it. So let me describe why I think House Bill 3547, as it's written, is a very narrow bill. First, I want to thank Representative Gilliam and others who are bringing this forward. I have to say that anybody who wants to wade into this area of the law, something I have been working on since 2012, is more than welcome to wade into that pool. A lot of other bills this session that I hope around, particularly around campaign finance, that I actually hope we address as well, especially a bill around all of the what I would call dark money transactions, where transactions under $100, either as a contribution or expense, those are not clearly show up in ORSTAR. They just show up as miscellaneous, and there's quite literally millions of dollars of miscellaneous. So I hope we address all of these ORSTAR problems. So House Bill 3547, as written, has some likely constitutional problems. I've submitted the LC opinion for you. The Dash 2 amendment gets us closer to what I think the bill sponsors clearly said that they intended, which is relates to transparency. But because of the relating to clause, some other things I would have liked to have included into the amendment can't be, but I'll certainly address them as well. And maybe something that this committee can do as a committee bill later in the session. So as written, House Bill 3547 seeks to make more transparent the payment to a legislator or a member of their family for any services to help a candidate paid for out of a candidate's political action committee for work relating to strategy around campaign communications, print advertising, advertisings made on the internet or social media. That's what the bill currently describes. So as that is written, it doesn't address a numerous other scenarios that I think they are seeking to address. So let me outline a few of those for you. That the Dash 2 would cover. So I own a business called PIP Communications, and at the heart of our core business, we provide database management services, web hosting, and basic web design coding services, as well as accounting services to a company I sold in 2013 to my former business partner. Our primary business at the time was to do this work in the coupon industry space. So literally, we run a database that you can go and search for Kraft Cheese coupons and General Mills Cheerios coupons and figure out where those coupons were and who issued them. And quite frankly, millions of women across the country want to know that information. So we provide that information to them and ran that company. The company is still in existence without my ownership, but we still do all the back-end server data management. Literally one of the websites we owned as Coupon Girls has a Facebook fan following of about 1.4 million users. So that is truly the space that we live in. If you want crockpot recipes, I can direct you there. So my first campaign was no secret. It was very short, very contentious, and very expensive. And one of the things that I saw very quickly is we didn't have much in the way of infrastructure. So I literally sat and hand-coded maps all night long so I could go out and walk them the next morning and won my election, and I'm here. And the next time that something like this came up, we were asked as a family to support the Westland Police bond measure, and we ended up making maps for that. Effort. That is not the core business that we do, but we managed to find a way to automate that service. And then this election cycle had people who wanted us to do that same thing, and so we did. And to some extent, most of the work we did was in-kinded. Most of the work that was paid was work that was actually reimbursed for things like toner and maps and buying lists and for other people's districts that weren't mine. House Bill 3547, as it's written, doesn't cover that activity, but the Dash 2 amendments would. The other scenario is not covered by this. Senator Gelser's husband runs a business called Sensa LLC. Its sole purpose is to do campaign finance work, which is not uncomplicated. And those of you who have ever tried to attempt to be your own campaign treasurer, it's not worth it. And yet, it's a service that is required by law. We actually have to report in ORSTAR. It's not uncomplicated work. It requires two different sets of books to be maintained, one in the ORSTAR set of books, which has a lot of campaign finance laws around it and a lot of reporting requirements around it. And then you also have to actually do a set of books in your regular QuickBooks or whatever kind of accounting software that you do. It's not an activity that your typical bookkeeper wants to get into. So what happens, and I'm assuming I'm just not going to speak for Senator Gelser or her husband, but what happens is, like I described with the maps, your spouse takes on a role of your campaign, and then somebody knows that you have understood the law or you understood a process of the campaign industry, and they say, hey, can you do mine? And so I've had this conversation with Representative Rayfield. Peter Gelser does his books in a paid capacity. So I think it's, and so his business, if you go to SensaLLC.com, his whole business model says, I'm going to do campaign finance and website and do this accounting thing because it's very difficult. And frankly, I don't think Peter Gelser or anybody who does this work gets paid enough, because not only do you have to do the double set of accounting, you also have to, you know, send out a thank you letter and acknowledgement of the donation. And it's not fun work. Senator Thatcher's husband and family runs a company that places campaign field signs, big 8-foot signs or, you know, whatever down highways that say vote for whoever. And as the Dash 2s cover that, the bill as it's written does not. Representative then Bun Unger was paid while he was a legislator to work for Our Oregon. And Our Oregon is a political 501c something, and they receive PAC money from other PACs that get taxpayer funded dollars. The Dash 2s would include work like that, which is not currently in the bill, but the Dash 2s would allow that to happen. He was providing, of course, campaign strategy to a variety of campaigns in that work, both candidate and others, and should have been somehow recorded for the purpose of public records and transparency. Representative Hoyle mentioned the work paid out of a caucus PAC. 3547, as it's written, doesn't cover caucus PACs, so it needs an amendment right off the bat because it actually doesn't do what it says it's going to do. That work also needs to be in-kinded and follow the in-kind laws. So if you were to have Future PAC or Promote Oregon pays for somebody to do campaign work, that should not only show up in ORSTAR, not through a third-party accounting, but it should show up in ORSTAR if we're talking about legislators and members of their family, show up as paid to X legislator or X member of their family, but then also being kinded to the PAC whose work you're doing on a pro rata basis. So if the value's, say, $2,000 and you're supporting 10 campaigns, then $200 should be prorated into somebody's PAC very clearly so that you can see this. The Dash 2 amendment allows that to happen and requires that to happen as part of the campaign reporting. Now, the Dash 2s also delete a section of 3547 for the purpose of the reporting side. As written, looking at and understanding the ORSTAR site that I, as in the way I've, we've made some modifications to ORSTAR before that were very easy for the Secretary of State's office to do. In 2013, I brought forward a bill to change the in-kind reporting, and they were able to do that within the construct of ORSTAR without having to do massive modifications. The way the reporting is set up in 3547, I think, is going to be problematic for ORSTAR. It would actually require significant coding to make that happen so that it's searchable. What the Dash 2 suggest is that when you pay someone, whether it's a PIP Communications or Sensa LLC or the caucus leader or whoever, and you make that transaction, If you were to reimburse somebody's spouse right now, there's a category in ORSTAR that says candidate's immediate family. The simple thing to do would just be to then have two drop-down menus that say this was money that was paid to a legislator, this is money that was paid to a legislator's family. Very simple, very searchable, doesn't take a huge overhaul of ORSTAR to do, and then you can actually go through and pull it as an individual search and see anybody who's receiving campaign finance dollars. So I think that's a really important thing to note, is that there is a mechanism to do that, and then have it follow the traditional reporting so that every time that transaction occurs, it's following whether we're 30-day reporting or we're 7-day reporting, it would actually show up as part of that process. So I think that's how you get the bill better. I think that's how you get the transparency that people are asking for to have and be seen. I think it needs to include all political action committees, not just candidate PACs. That would be caucus PACs, issue PACs, or any other type of political action committee that might be there, so that it is all indeed searchable. I'm totally willing to hold us to that standard, and I think the dash 2 gets us there. You'll see in the legal opinion, though, that there is still this kind of some of the constitutional questions, even with the dash 2. And I want to describe why I think that the underlying bill does have a problem. So Representative Mark Johnson is a Republican state representative from Hood River. His son is a Democrat, and his son has been paid to work on Democratic campaigns. And so as written, this bill would require Representative Johnson to be held accountable for his son's actions and require a whole bunch of reporting about the nature of his work and, frankly, the way partisan campaigns work. I don't think that any Democratic campaign is going to pay Nels Johnson to do that work and then have to have his dad be the person who's the arbiter of that work and making that reportable as part of his work as a legislator. Now, Nels Johnson also doesn't live with his father, so, you know, at this point he's a grown man with a real career. And he just happens to be on the other side of the aisle from his father, and this bill could preclude him as written from having work. Now, if he chose to go work for a Republican or a Democratic campaign, and his, you know, the candidate who hires him knows that, then when they pay him, they can simply use the drop-down menu I'm proposing in ORSTAR that would say member of a candidate's family and be able to be covered that way without having the what is he doing and all of the strategy piece put forward. But you would see he's being paid for consulting or map making or, you know, treasury services or any other thing that is sort of unique to this industry. Because the real question here is, but for the fact that we have a lot of rules and laws around campaigns, would we be doing this work? But for that Representative Hoyle is the caucus leader and her job is to get Democrats elected, and Rep. McClain is the Republican leader and his job is to get Republicans elected, does this work exist? Now, if I didn't make maps for people, PIP Communications keeps making coupon websites and databases and actually is even taking the step of putting somebody's art gallery online, like things that have nothing to do with campaigns, and we still get paid, and that's the majority of our money. That does show up on SEI statements, and there are things that, remember I said at the beginning of this testimony, aren't included. If we really, really want to be transparent, then we would also, you know, include things, although the relating to clause doesn't let us do that. If I buy my print services from my brother-in-law's print shop, now I have no brother-in-law who owns a print shop, but if that was the case and I hired him, that doesn't show up because it would just show up to Sam's print shop. This bill doesn't cover that, and the relating to clause doesn't let us. If we really, really want to be transparent, Nels Johnson is also a lobbyist, and if any firm that he gets has PAC money and he gives money to his father, that should show up as, you know, somewhere in ORSTAR as being a relationship where there's a familial relationship and money's been given to a candidate and the child or the, you know, sibling or the parent is a lobbyist. You know, your Representative Wilson, your son's a lobbyist in this building. If you got any, you know, PAC money from AOY, it's not showing up. It shows up maybe on your statement of economic interest, but it doesn't show up in ORSTAR where it is readily searchable to the public. This bill can't fix that, but if we're serious about doing this, then those things should be included in a separate bill. And with that, I will take any questions.
Thank you so much, and thank you for adding to the things that we could and should look at. I think that's important. I know that Senator Gelzer, so getting used to that, Senator Gelzer does not hire her husband. She doesn't pay her husband out of her PAC. Is that something that that I haven't read through your amendment? Is that something there about specifically using one's own PAC to pay into your own family?
No, this would be if your spouse or somebody in your household or even the legislator was providing any services to any political action committee, the Dash 2s cover that scenario for everybody, whether it was directly being paid for out of the candidate's PAC for a family member or the candidate was or the candidate's family member, the legislator's family member was doing those services for any PAC.
Right, and we may want to look at this other piece because, again, personally benefiting from one's own PAC.
Yes, I would say, Chair Hoyle, yes, the Dash 2 does cover that.
So that's important. And then we can offline have a longer discussion about the difference between a consultant and an employee of a campaign, because I think that that differentiation may there may be a different interpretation. But we will come back and have many discussions about these, and I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3547, open a public hearing on House Bill 3331. Erin, will you describe the measure? And I would like to invite up Representative Gail Whitsitt and Senator Doug Whitsitt.
And excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3331 authorizes Legislative Assembly to appoint independent counsel by joint resolution. There is an emergency clause on this measure. It comes to you with no revenue impact. A fiscal impact statement has not yet been issued.
Whoever would like to start first.
I'm Representative Gail Whitsitt from House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake Counties. Good afternoon, Chair Hoyle and committee members. We're bringing House Bill 3331 to you today. We developed the concept for this bill in November of 2014, when it was apparent that major problems existed in the executive branch of Oregon state government, and we had a governor who appeared to have no intention of being accountable for a number of ethics issues surrounding his immediate household. The rest is history, and HB 3331 was finalized in February of 2015 by Legislative Council. This after the former governor chose to resign. We still have an executive branch that has the option of being non-responsive to the citizens and to the legislature if it so desires. Had John Kitzhaber not chosen to leave office voluntarily, the only recourse to remove him would have been by a recall, which could have taken many months or even years. Few people understood until this scandal was uncovered by the media just how difficult it would be for the state to investigate a sitting governor or their family or any employee of the executive branch. Our Attorney General chose not to investigate the matter until the FBI had already begun an investigation, despite near constant urging by the press, the citizens, and many legislators. This bill would correct that by allowing the legislative branch, by joint resolution, to request that the Attorney General conduct a preliminary investigation and then decide whether further investigation is warranted with respect to potential violations or allegations of violations identified in the joint resolution of ethics or criminal laws. The process involved will go something like this. Number one, upon passage of the joint resolution, the AG must conduct the preliminary investigation by promptly notifying the appropriate circuit court of the beginning of the investigation and the date it is to begin. Number two, a determination of reasonable grounds to further the investigation shall be made within 60 days of the passage of the joint resolution. Number three, in determining whether reasonable grounds exist to warrant further investigation, the AG shall comply with the written or other established policies of the Department of Justice with respect to the conduct of criminal investigations. Number four, the AG, upon completion of the preliminary investigation, shall report the results to the Legislative Assembly, and they shall make all reports public. Number five, if the AG determines there are not grounds to continue a further investigation, then the AG shall include this determination in a report to the Legislative Assembly, and the legislature shall have no power to appoint an independent counsel. Number six, if the AG determines there are reasonable grounds to further the investigation, this shall be included in the report to the legislature, and the AG shall apply to the circuit court for the appointment of an independent counsel. Number seven, If 60 days elapse and the AG has not made a report to the legislature, then the AG shall apply directly to the circuit court for an appointment of an independent counsel. Number 8, applications for the appointment of an independent counsel shall contain sufficient information to assist the circuit court in selecting an independent counsel and in defining that counsel's prosecutorial jurisdiction so that the independent counsel has adequate authority to fully investigate and prosecute the subject matter and all subject matters related. Number 9, the AG's determination under this subsection to apply to the circuit court for the appointment of the independent counsel shall not be reviewable in any court. Number 10, if after making a report to the legislative body, the AG receives additional information sufficient to constitute grounds to investigate matters to which the report related under subsection 3 of this bill, the AG shall, A, conduct an additional preliminary investigation of not more than 30 days after the date on which the additional information was received, and B, comply with the provisions of this section with respect to the additional preliminary investigation to the same extent as to any other preliminary investigation. The independent counsel shall have all of the powers of a district attorney and may write and serve a subpoena upon any person with relevant materials. He may also call in the state police or other police officers to assist in the investigation. Further, the independent counsel may convene a grand jury, prepare indictments, and shall have the power to investigate potential violations and allegations of violations of ethics laws identified in the Legislative Assembly's joint resolution. In conclusion, I would like to reiterate the lack of accountability the ever-powerful executive branch of Oregon's government has to the people of this state. We, the duly elected Legislative Assembly of the state, are the only timely voice that the citizens have to request that an investigation be undertaken regarding anyone in the administrative branch of the government who believes themselves to be above the law or above any official ethics statutes in the case of public officials. The present ethics board never did convene in a timely manner to investigate the scandal involving the past governor. Timeliness is of great importance in the ongoing inquiries and perhaps related issues which may come to light as a result of these investigations. I do not believe we, as a state, can wait to put these ethics issues on the ballot in 2018, which has been suggested. An immediate addition of this bill to statute by the 2015 legislature and signed into law by the present governor should guarantee that all public officials can and will be held accountable to the citizens of Oregon for their actions. Thank you for your time to hear this very important bill, and legislative council believed an amendment clarifying that this bill is only for the administrative branch was in order, so you have a dash one amendment in front of you, which states that. Thank you.
Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing District 28, Klamath, Crook, most of Lake, Deschutes, and Jackson counties. The Legislative Assembly currently has no authority to initiate the investigation or the prosecution of elected, appointed, employed, or contracted executive branch officials. We believe that they should. House Bill 3331 creates that limited authority by allowing appropriate and well-tested federal guidelines employed by Congress. It creates a balanced and guarded pathway to establish a nonpartisan professional investigation. It provides for the court appointment of an independent prosecutor when appropriate. House Bill 3331 carefully limits the jurisdiction of that independent prosecutor to only the subject of the investigation named in the legislative joint resolution. I urge the committee's support of House Bill 3331 as amended with a dash one amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Anyone? Yes, Representative Rayfield.
I guess one of my main concerns is this would be used for, you know, kind of partisan political purposes. And so when I was looking through the bill, I didn't see, my assumption is that it would only take a majority of folks to actually get this passed, as opposed to, we heard an impeachment bill earlier that required a two-thirds. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, it would require a majority vote of both chambers as a joint resolution. And then that would trigger the requirement for the Attorney General to investigate. The Attorney General would then determine whether there was cause for further action. If so, if not, the investigation is over and the legislature no longer has any authority. If the Attorney General decides that there is a situation that needs to be resolved, then they would, that person would, the Attorney General would apply to the Circuit Court for a special prosecutor. If the Attorney General did not wish to become involved or could actually be the subject of the investigation, then they would simply wait the 60 days out and the Circuit Court would appoint a special prosecutor. So I don't think there's any way to take politics out of politics. But the idea here is to try to, if you have a majority in both chambers, ask the Attorney General to investigate and then follow the lead of the and is not challengeable.
I'd like to say that legislative counsel told us that this bill that you have before you is based on the federal law regarding the appointment of independent counsel, which arose out of the post-Watergate era. So this is precedent, not precedent setting, based on federal law for independent counsels.
A couple of follow-ups. Mm-hmm. The and so it doesn't sound like, and I don't know if you know, are there other states that do this, and do other states have other protections like a two-thirds requirement to get around or to avoid some of the partisan issues?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Rayfield, I do not know.
I don't know either. Just this is based on federal law, so.
Okay. And then, and I'm the attorney, so I just kind of been sitting next to another one. One of the other questions that I had was there was in determining whether reasonable grounds exist, and that seems to me what the Attorney General, their burden of proof would be, is reasonable grounds. And I was kind of curious what that meant. Is that a more likely true than not true standard? Is it a higher standard before they agree to move forward further with their investigation or
in
to
the,
have someone appoint the independent counsel?
In the case of criminal wrongdoing, it is the standard that the Attorney General uses for criminal cases. So whatever that standard is what they would be not doing anything different than they already do to set for criminal, and the ethics would be regarding what our ethics laws are in the state. So,
Madam Chair,
yes,
Representative Rayfield, I would, I'm certainly not an attorney, you are. But it would seem to me that an ethics violation would most likely be the civil preponderance of evidence to get it going if it was actually a criminal charge, and I would think it would be a preponderance of evidence.
The last fault
is, final follow-up.
Is there a fiscal on the bill? Because obviously this would require additional investigations.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Yes,
thank
Representative
you, Madam
Warner.
Chair. I just wanted to briefly touch on the idea of a supermajority, and because I would just say that, I mean, in this state, we need a supermajority to raise taxes, which is a pretty basic function of government. And I just, I acknowledge your point, Senator, that it is hard to take politics out of politics. At the same time, it just seems, you know, it just seems reasonable to have some threshold beyond simple majority to instigate such a significant investigatory power. And I would really worry that it might be taken too easily if it's just a simple majority.
I would just say it would be just as easy for a supermajority to protect their own party, or a majority to protect their own party, if they chose not to go forward with this. I mean, you know, it works both ways.
Fair enough. But yes, Representative McLean.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Representative Whitsitt for bringing this bill. The irony is that one could argue that it was partisan politics that even produced the necessity for this bill, where a Democratic attorney general refused to investigate a Democrat governor who had clearly stonewalled the production of documents for 6 months. And then she, after refusing to investigate him, she finally did and you know, was asked by the U.S. attorney not to investigate, which, of course, one wonders why, whether partisan bent that was clearly evident would have actually produced an investigation that was unbiased. So I think what I read this bill is actually trying to bring partisanship back into what is a balanced approach. Because I'm not sure if anyone could really argue that partisanship didn't come into play at the fact that our attorney general just refused to investigate the governor.
I want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. I myself am confident there is a federal investigation, and I would wait until we see what comes out of that federal investigation. But my belief is that they are attending to this, taking it serious, and attending to this and doing their job as well as possible. And I do not believe that if there is evidence of wrongdoing or a crime, that they will overlook that. But that's my belief in the system.
Madam Chair, if I may comment, I certainly am pleased that the federal government decided to investigate. And I'm sure it will get past its the U.S. Attorney's resignation in doing so. But simply put, to have the legislative branch be able to bring the spotlight to bear what one party blocked is a balance I think the people of Oregon want, and we sure as the Dickens need.
Thank you so much. And with that, I will bring up Josh Nasby and Aaron Knott. And who would like to go first?
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nasby, and I'm...
Would you bring the microphone a little bit closer? Not too close. Yeah, about that. That's right.
Thank you. My name is Josh Nasby, and I'm staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. The Oregon Judicial Department is neutral on this bill. We have no position. I just wanted to bring one issue to your attention, and I think it was touched on briefly, and that is... which of these three entities involved in this process is going to bear the expense of compensating the independent prosecutor and the expense associated with the investigation? The bill, as I read it, is silent, and I took a quick look at the 1994 federal law this morning. Roughly a third of that is devoted to sort of how the independent prosecutor is compensated and the like. So as you deliberate on this going forward, I just encourage you to consider the consider adopting provisions addressing the financial issue. Thank you.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice and the Oregon Attorney General, here in opposition to House Bill 3331. And I'm coming at this from a couple of different angles. The first one is a constitutional concern. Now, we've talked a lot about the federal system. The federal system differs from our Oregon state system in a significant way that is relevant here. The federal constitution, there are three branches of government, but there's not a lot of description about how they should be compartmentalized. In Oregon, on the other hand, they are meant to be kept separate. You are the legislature. You make the laws. We are the executive. We execute the laws. What that means as a general principle is you can articulate legislative requirements, but you can't target them at individual people. 3331 steps into what I would call constitutionally dangerous territory insofar as it and the term in 3331 is initially request, but it moves essentially to order the executive branch to carry out a specific investigation of a person. and that comes very close to a legislative action that is targeted at just one person. That is generally outside of your purview. You can ask us to carry out investigations, but at the point that you order it, you've stepped into a new territory. But even beyond that, there's some specific procedural issues with the way 3331 is written that are concerning. First of all, 3331, you request upon a simple majority that the Attorney General initiates an investigation. We do so. On the 60th day, we are required to come back to you and give a report. This report is public record. That's contained in 3331. This provision seems outside, in fact, badly outside of how prosecutions are usually handled. In fact, there's a public records exception for when you're preparing for litigation or doing something like a criminal records or a criminal investigation. Here's why. Indictments can take a long time to prepare. Regardless of your feeling about the merits, one way or another, of the investigation about the former governor, it's taking a while, and that's not unusual. Indictments of white-collar crime, complex drug rings, these things take far longer than 60 days. And a requirement that the Attorney General come forward and essentially lay all cards out on the table after 60 days has the potential to badly prejudice an investigation. At that point, we're not just outlining who we're investigating. That would be known from the fact that you requested us to do it. We're also outlining who our witnesses are, what physical evidence we have available, what our broad legal strategies are. And this is all being done before we have the security of any sort of an indictment. Once you get an indictment, you can impose conditions, no contact orders, you have a judge involved. At this point, we're basically just giving the playbook to the public without any security. From a prosecutorial perspective, I would submit that that's actually making your goal less likely, and you need to reconsider that idea that we should be coming back in 60 days. Either that period needs to be pushed dramatically further out, or we need to rethink fundamentally the idea of making public legal strategies on a pending prosecution. So, in terms of the appointment of independent counsel, the Office of the Attorney General has this power now. We oppose Special Assistant Attorneys General, or SAGs. We do this for a number of different reasons. If we face a novel legal question that we don't feel like we have the technical capacity to answer, and that does happen, we'll bring in SAGs. Sometimes if there's a conflict that is significant enough that our office doesn't feel like they can move forward, we bring in SAGs. So the way this is structured, we do a preliminary investigation, and then we are required by law to appoint, well, we don't appoint a SAG, that's done by the circuit court. So when you bring in a SAG, you're bringing in necessarily additional expense, because this is essentially mandatory retained counsel that you have to keep for the life of that case. That will have the effect of pushing up the fiscal cost of any investigation you do here, because you are bringing in, as a matter of requirement, outside counsel. And the Attorney General is relatively unique in that we do criminal and civil investigations, and as you've already heard, this requires both. You're looking at civil ethics, you're looking at criminal violations. There aren't that many actors that can do this effectively. And it's not enough to say you're just bringing in one person. You need all the resources of an office. You need the people that can look at discovery. You need physical locations where you can house the evidence, do depositions. It's complicated. It's not just one person coming in with a crown and they're the special prosecutor. So, and then finally, what I would submit here is the way this is structured, where we do the preliminary investigation, then there's a special prosecutor. Indulging for the moment what I would take to be the cynical belief that the Attorney General cannot be trusted to do ethical investigations, assuming for the moment that that is true, having us do the preliminary investigation does not make any sense. At that point, what do? We canvass the investigation. We draw whatever evidence we want within 60 days. We draw whatever conclusions we want to. And then we either shut the thing down or appoint a special prosecutor. If it is in fact true that ours is not a trustworthy office, then we can simply refuse to go forward or not present all evidence. If you're going to be that cynical, you have to ask these questions. So if we are not to be trusted, the special prosecutor makes no sense. If we are to be trusted, this is an unnecessary expense. In neither case is the construction of this bill as currently written good for Oregon. So we oppose bills very, very rarely, but we felt the need to do that here. And I'm open for any questions.
Representative McLean.
your comments could be interpreted as sort of a straw man argument, that you've given us this only position that's juxtaposed to the integrity of the Attorney General as to the motive for wanting a special prosecutor. I don't agree with your assessment. The fact that the legislative branch may want a special prosecutor or may feel that its constitutional duties require that the governor or anyone else in the executive branch have to produce documents and bring these things to light doesn't mean that the legislative branch is cynical. In fact, I think the insinuation that we would somehow be cynical could be insulting to the sponsors of the bill. I think what they're trying to say is that the legislative branch, the first and the foundational branch of our government, wants to have the ability to investigate and would only do so after giving not an investigative power, a preliminary investigation, which acts in essence, if you will, like a grand jury. In essence, the Attorney General is able to say, look, there's no basis here, or yes, there is basis here, let's go ahead and start an investigation. And it's that latter, too, I must question your characterization of a preliminary investigation. Well, sure, investigations that lead to indictments taken in an inordinate length of time to be thorough, but ultimately 60 days to do a preliminary investigation to judge whether there's any reasonable basis is not unheard of to put a deadline in that regard. Is it the position of the Attorney General that she views Representative Whitsitt's motive for this bill as being cynical?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, that was a response to what I felt was a characterization of our office as having elected to sit on our hands and withheld an investigation. It's nothing about the facial content of the bill or the motives of the sponsor. It was a remark to a comment that was made earlier, and it was certainly not my intent to insult anyone.
And further, it is certainly public record and acknowledgement that the Attorney General is the same political party as the governor, correct?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, I agree.
Under views by a couple of members of the committee that there could be partisan motives for the legislative branch, it certainly won't, you think, it be appropriate to simply point out that having one party control the executive branch may lead to some suspect that there would have been less than earnest motivation?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, that's a hard question for me to answer. I mean, mostly I just am here to testify on 3331, but what I would submit is the way it's structured would damage a prosecution that you want to see happen. This is the point I want to emphasize. If we went this route, after you used the term preliminary investigation, now it's not entirely clear what that means. We know it's not an indictment. It's not a legal term of art as far as I know. So something anterior to indictment, we'd gather evidence and then we'd present it to the legislature. And I think there are consequences for doing that in terms of getting a prosecution. You'll notice this isn't something that district attorneys do.
May I have a follow-up?
Absolutely.
Is it the position of the Attorney General that 60 days is too short in order to produce a preliminary investigation that would make the conclusion on whether there is reasonable evidence, or evidence that would at least create reasonable suspicion that an ethics or some other violation occurred?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, the issue is partially the public disclosure of what we found. It really does seem to have the effect of disclosing the nature, the strategy, what witnesses were planning on relying on. I think it is the case that 60 days is not always soon enough to review, potentially to use the gubernatorial example, the thousands and thousands of documents. And my understanding is that there are actually teams of lawyers just processing public records requests, just looking at documentary evidence. And that takes time, even with a fairly resource-rich environment, which we do not always have. And I don't think you can say that after 60 days you will know in every case. But I want to emphasize again, my concern is not just coming back to the legislature and having a discussion. It's publicizing a pre-indictment criminal investigation. And, I mean, maybe we could talk about the scope of what needs to be publicized. Maybe that's something we could discuss in terms of amendments. But right now, I think that's very hazardous. And no, 60 days is not categorically sufficient for a criminal investigation.
Is there a constitutional challenge based upon what you would say targeting one individual by the legislative branch? Couldn't it be simply characterized as investigations necessary to determine what policy adjustments need to be made? In other words, we don't have the power to prosecute, but certainly a special prosecutor could produce for the legislative branch a discovery process and a report back to us as to whether crimes or ethic violations were committed so that we could make the necessary adjustments going forward. I would think that would be a sufficient separation of powers argument to justify the bill.
And Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, at the point that the legislature has the ability to directly command executive branch type activity, because that's the test, is not just is it historically a person or office that's designated to the as executive branch, but is it an executive branch type function? So in this case, if you have a special prosecutor who's doing that kind of work for you, at the point that they come back to you, they are essentially responsive to you and you are directing them, and I'm not sure if that's what you were suggesting or not, that would be an appropriation of an executive function.
Thank you.
Representative Rahill.
And I would just kind of point out, I assume that kind of what you're getting at in with the effectiveness of an investigation would be is sometimes in the criminal context, we don't even notify the criminals that we're engaged in an investigation for a strategic matter. And in this point, actually, from the very outset, we're saying, hey, we're conducting an investigation, and then we're giving them the information. So I just kind of would note that for the committee. The other thing that as we were talking through this, a really interesting question came up in my mind, because not all investigations are done in 60 days, and sometimes it's just impossible to do it. But what I envision is you're going 60 days with extensive, let's say you've got 12 people working on these records requests, you get to your 60 days, you can't complete the investigation the way you want it. 60 days, your work is undone, then they appoint an independent investigator. Is all of that work that you did during that 60 days for naught, or does that get to move over to the independent investigator? How does that work?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Rayfield, I think that is accounted for in the bill. We're to share the contents of our investigation with a special prosecutor. So at that point, I don't think you'd have a problem sort of porting over the work that we did. I mean, there'd be the logistics of it, yeah, trying to actually generate reports or memoranda enough to make them understand what we already did. That's not so much the issue. The issue is more just that we might not know whether moving forward makes sense. One of the real constitutional catch-alls in here, and I think what gives the bill the punching chance at constitutionality, is the decision about whether or not to go forward is left to the Attorney General. That's our discretion. But if we haven't gotten through the preliminary evidence and we run out the clock and boom, we have to appoint a special prosecutor, we've basically lost that constitutional protection.
Thank you.
Representative Nose. Okay. And before I call on Representative Gilliam, I will say that to follow up on Representative McLean's comments, I would, one, caution you from assigning motor intent either from the sponsors of the bill or from someone from the dais. I think people were expressing concerns, so I that may not have been your intent, but that's the way it sounded. And then I would also like to point out that just because people are elected from the same party, that is different than, again, saying that there is intent. You can point out that people are from the same party, but I think, you know, expressing what their motive or intent is for action is different. So I'll just put that on the record. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron, you mentioned the possibility from your perspective of this being unconstitutional. Do you feel comfortable saying a word about how that portion at the state level compares to the federal level?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Gilliam, we've actually done some work on that question in the past, so I've looked into that as much as I could in preparation for this hearing. It's the federal government doesn't it, we have three branches in both, but in the federal government, there's no discrete requirement that those three branches be held separate. They're allowed to collaborate quite a bit. The way that Oregon's language is structured and has been interpreted by the courts, the requirements are a little bit more separate. And I'll tell you candidly, there, as far as we know, there's no case law directly on point with this question. And any time we're asked to heat check constitutionality for legislative purposes, we're basically trying to guess what a court would do, which is, of course, going to be hit or miss. But I can tell you with confidence that the standard plays out differently in Oregon than it does federally.
Thank you. And I have another question, if I might. I'm sorry.
Josh,
I think your comment was basically about the fiscal. Do you have an estimate, not in dollars, but even in FTEs, just some basis for the caution to take into account the fiscal on something like this?
Chair Horrell, Representative Gilliam, I do not. Quick Google work. This morning, the Ken Starr investigation, for example, was very expensive. But I think sort of fundamentally costs associated with investigating and prosecuting a criminal case, I would defer to my colleague outside the judicial branch. It's not something we sort of ordinarily deal with.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, I just would make one comment that I feel strongly about. We had two of our fellow legislators who I very much respect of great integrity bringing this bill forward. So I in no way want to denigrate what they're trying to do to make our government better. The exchanges so far, to me, point out it is too early to be discussing a bill like this because both sides, all sides, cannot resist references to the former governor who is under federal investigation. And I would again repeat, probably my colleagues don't want to hear this. I will not support any bill directed at the executive in this session, as important as it may be, simply because it's too soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? And Dexter Johnson. I called you. You ran out into the hallway. You can't. You can run, but you cannot hide.
Chair Hoyle, members. Good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, and here with me is Staff Attorney Emily Moss, also from Legislative Council. We are on 3331. There we go. And I don't have any prepared remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I've heard some questions that I can just go ahead and answer. Would that be so, Representative Rayfield? You asked about the supermajority requirement. To impose that in this would require a constitutional amendment because the legislature under the Constitution now, unless it says otherwise, generally only requires a simple majority in order to take action. So that's a reason why there's no supermajority vote. Questions raised about separation of powers, and we believe that this is structured in such a way it does come close, but we believe it is structured in such a way that this is in compliance with separation of powers requirements. The legislature here is merely asking another state agency to do something. That is what the legislature does all the time. And the Legislative Assembly is not engaging in prosecution itself. It is asking the Attorney General and Department of Justice to conduct a preliminary investigation. And the legislature asking a state agency to do something is happens all the time. And then is directing the Attorney General to come back and report to the legislature. That, too, is a very common practice. I heard some questions or concerns about the disclosure that is needed in terms of for the 60-day report period where the Attorney General reports the results of a preliminary investigation. Concern about that disclosing too much information. There is no real standard there in terms of what must be disclosed, and so the Attorney General is aware of how criminal prosecutions are conducted, and I believe would have the expertise to be able to determine what may be disclosed sufficiently to report to you that there is reasonable grounds for investigating without disclosing too much to impair a subsequent prosecution. And then I heard one other. The other question I heard deals with financing. This bill does not address financing for this. It is, one response I would have to financing is that this is likely to be a very rare thing that could happen, maybe only once in 20 years. And so the emergency board process is there to deal with unexpected expenses like that would be. And so this simply could, either the bill could remain silent or you could put some language in about how the Attorney General could go to the emergency board for funding in the event that some action, that you pass a resolution calling for an independent counsel to investigate. I think those are the, in a nutshell, all the questions that I heard.
Representative Noss.
So I'm going to, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask the question I want to ask earlier, but now it seems more appropriate. Which would be better, to have an impeachment process or to have this and then have this bill inform an impeachment process? Because it seems like both kind of do the same thing, or maybe I'm just getting confused.
Madam Chair, Representative Noss, that is a policy question, policy dispute. So it would be up to you as a body to decide which is a better approach. And you need not have them. They could both be there.
Thank you. Representative McLean.
Dexter, does, under our Constitution, does the legislative branch have subpoena power and the ability to compel witnesses to appear before us?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, yes, the two presiding officers do, and the either the chair or vice chair of a committee does upon majority vote of that committee. They can both subpoena witnesses to attend or compel the production of documents.
Is there any constitutional prohibition against the legislative branch using that subpoena power and ability to compel testimony and production of documents from forming for the purposes of policy analysis, an investigation the likes of which is contemplated in this House bill?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, the purpose of the subpoena power, the legislature's subpoena power, is not to itself conduct a prosecution of someone, but rather to gather information from which to make policy decisions. So you could not, through the legislature's subpoena power, accomplish what this bill would direct the Attorney General and the independent counsel to do.
All right. Just follow up. For the purposes of an investigation as to whether adjustments in the ethics or civil laws, criminal laws, needs to be made, does the legislature branch have the ability to conduct an investigation, including subpoenaing documents from third parties or compelling testimony before hearings under oath?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, yes.
All right, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We may need you for another bill, so be here. So with that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3331. Thank you, Representative and Senator, for bringing this forward. Okay, and I'm going to open up the next three hearings. Representative Parrish, you're here on all three bills, so I'll just open them up all at once, understanding that we also have a number of people who are testifying, so, and we have 50 minutes left. So with that, I will open up public hearings on House Bill 2790, 2791, and House Bill 3043.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. Again, Representative Julie Parrish from Westland and Tualatin. And Chair Hoyle, 2791, 2790, and what was the third one?
3043.
So it doesn't get us to the public records one, so I'll set that aside. So briefly, I'm going to start with 2970 and 2971 because they are sort of twins and related, and the problem in both addresses both, so I'm actually glad that you opened up both at the same time. Since being elected, there have been several occasions where this body, I believe, was misled by agencies or elected officials who came to the legislature to give us information, which was then used by legislators to make important and critical decisions. Two such examples since I have been elected. ODOT has made statements during the testimony about whether or not the effects of tolling as it would relate to the CRC and in our transportation committee, and about what the effects of tolling would look like as we made the decision about the bill to do the Columbia River crossing. I sat in that committee and listened to the testimony. It was later sort of deemed that the tolling statements were inaccurate and didn't clearly reflect the future cost to taxpayers of tolls should revenues not come in as predicted by ODOT. The result would have been excessive tolling for consumers, which would have made the cost of traveling across the CRC untenable. But nowhere has the data provided to the legislature been more egregiously presented to us than as it related to Cover Oregon. The legislature was repeatedly told that Cover Oregon was on time and on budget. Later, news accounts told a different story of a project that was bleeding money and was never going to be on time. As we later saw, the project consumed somewhere near $300 million and never enrolled a single Oregonian via the website. If the legislature is relying on data from agencies from which to make decisions, then the data should be factual, honest, and reflect the true state of affairs of the agency. This is not the case in these two high-profile bills that we heard in this body. Even just recently, the legislature was given information by the Oregon Department of Energy for Senate Bill 324, the low-carbon fuel standard bill. The agency, on a Friday evening after the close of business and after the vote, retracted some of their testimony and later came back and said what they presented to us was not indeed the case, and in fact, and that was after the vote had been held. So the solution, in my mind, is that in order to ensure that the information we receive from other elected officials and from those representing public agencies is indeed truthful, House Bill 2790 would require that a written or oral statement made to the legislative committee shall be done so under oath, affirmation, or declaration, or be subject to Oregon's perjury laws around false swearing. An elected official is pretty clear in this bill. It's any of us who've been elected by a vote of the people in our community. So that could be, school board members. It could be water district members. If you've been voted on by the people, you would be under this bill. A person in charge of an agency would be a director, deputy director, chief executive officer, or other person authorized to make executive decisions concerning a public agency. Public agency under this bill would mean a commission, board, agency, or other governmental or quasi-governmental agency, which indeed is sort of what Cover Oregon was. Had this bill been in effect and had, for example, the folks who, I believe, lied to the legislature about the status of Cover Oregon, had that been under this language, instead of golden parachutes, there might have been an outcome where we got truthful information from which we could make better decision, and 150,000 Oregonians would not have lost their health care coverage. Those who engaged in false testimony of the legislature would have actually been held accountable. I believe that if the legislature doesn't resolve this issue, there's going to be, we're always going to be in the position where others with an agenda cannot tell us the truth, give us untruthful information, and then we use that information to make decisions, which I think has shown to have, in particularly in the case of Cover Oregon, disastrous outcomes for Oregonian. Similar to House Bill 2970 is 2971, which seeks to address the same problem but in a little bit different way. House Bill 2971 would create a punishment of a Class B misdemeanor for the crime of unsworn false testimony. So the first bill says you'll come and take an oath and swear and affirm, and the second says, no, you'll just come and present us the information and be truthful. Class B misdemeanor is categorized as a jail sentence of up to 6 months in a county jail or a fine of up to $2,500. Again, had this been in effect in 2012 when the legislature was given this false information by those leading Cover Oregon, they hadn't been sworn in to provide us any public testimony. The public would have had a mechanism, we would have had a mechanism by which those individuals would be held accountable. Again, I think it's important to note that over the history of our state, the legislature has increasingly ceded our authority to state agencies, the administrative rule process, and in large part to the executive branch directly. That was not the history of our state. That is not how the Oregon legislature was founded, but over years, by little incremental bits and pieces, and you've heard people even like Vicky Berger stand up on the House floor and sort of rail about that in certain bills. It seems like every session since I've been here, we've done this sort of ceding of our authority, and I think it's time to pull some of that back. So in order to get accountability and bring that back into our purview, House Bill 2970 and 71, I think, are steps in the right direction. So I'll pause there on those two bills since they are sort of linked.
So this is testimony on 2790, 2791, testifying under oath. Questions, comments? Okay.
All right, moving on.
Yep.
So 3043 is a bill that addresses the issue of governor's spouse. And I appreciate Governor Brown bringing a version of this bill forward. And certainly, if that's the bill that comes forward, I will support that bill, but I don't think the bill really examines the problem the right way. So, and this really is, we could argue, particularly Representative Gilliam, that whether or not that this is a John Kitzhaber problem, this is also a problem in Virginia, where the Republican governor and his spouse had similar issues and were criminally prosecuted. So we know this issue exists, not just in our state. With the exit of Governor John Kitzhaber, though, however, and the subsequent release of emails detailing the questionable level of power and authority bestowed to Sylvia Hayes, it's clear that our statutes, which say almost nothing about the appropriate role of a governor's partner, be updated for modern times, recognizing that a governor's spouse is no longer just a stay-at-home wife. But that in conducting business outside of the home, there is a problem that was highlighted by both Kitzhaber and the Republican governor of Virginia, where the spouse became an access point of public policy, and in the result that was found in the case of the Virginia governor, the Republican governor, corruption in the form of kickbacks to the executive's family. While the case against Governor Kitzhaber will have whatever outcome it's going to have, and we know that that's pending against he and Ms. Hayes, what we do know is we have an identified problem right now that is not just an Oregon problem. It is a problem across all 50 states, and we have an opportunity to actually address that right now. And particularly given that we do have a new governor, let's provide her spouse with a pathway and future spouses to have a clear and defined role. So what the bill does, House Bill 3043 allows the governor to make an election upon swearing in the ability to elect a first spouse and appoint that person. Now, I don't care what that person's called. That is up to the governor who's elected. And so for the purpose of this legislation, though, we are calling it a first spouse. And then whatever ceremonial moniker that the governor chooses to bestow on their spouse could indeed have whatever title. I'm not wedded to that. And in fact, there is precedent in our federal branch of government where a spouse was not somebody who was married to the governor, in fact was a relation to the governor and chose to do those duties. This bill actually allows for you to be not married and to assign that role. So House Bill 3403 says that within 72 hours of taking oath, the governor shall do one of three things: designate no one for that position, choose to designate a first spouse who will have no official duties, choose to designate a first spouse who will have official duties, a policy role, or an agenda-setting role within their administration. If the governor chooses to designate a first spouse, then that individual now would be required under this bill to report to the Ethics Commission for the purpose of filling out their own statement of economic interest and not just be attached to the governor's statement of economic interest. If the governor chooses that their spouse will have no official duties, then the only taxpayer resources that can be expended for the spouse is that the spouse can live at the governor's mansion and that the spouse can have this security services provided by our state police. I want to just say that regardless of, you know, the concern about taxpayer resources, I'm a firm believer in making sure that that position is safe. And so that is indeed something that is a carve out in this bill for that spouse. Again, the spouse would have to provide a statement of economic interest annually as it relates to accepting private employment, entering into contracts for business if the spouse is self-employed, and they would have to seek written determination that no conflict of interest exists. If the governor chooses to designate a first spouse, who will have a policymaking or agenda-setting role? The same as the above applies, but with some additional provisions. The governor shall have to draft a statement of work about what the policy or agenda-setting roles will be assigned to the first spouse. The governor will have to set a clear budget of how taxpayer resources shall be used. The governor shall have to set clear outcomes for how the program will serve Oregonians. The spouse shall attend ethics law training by the Ethics Commission. The governor shall be required to update when policy role changes are started, ended, or evolve into new policy work or agenda setting roles. A quarterly reporting to the Ethics Commission shall detail taxpayer resources expended for the work. The spouse may not use the title in relation to private employment or private business ventures. The spouse may testify at legislative hearings only in the capacity of the work that he or she has been assigned. The spouse may travel to events paid by public funds only if it relates to the duties they've been assigned by the governor. Otherwise, travel expenses are at the personal cost of the governor and his or her spouse. The spouse who has been assigned a policy or agenda-setting role may indeed use state resources to accomplish the work, but not for any other purpose or personal benefit. The bill also provides a really important cooling off period of 180 days for a spouse to do the work in the private sector. So, for example, our current Governor Brown had publicly stated that her spouse will not be in a money-making role from the governor's office, and I actually do take her at her face value on that. I find her to be very truthful and forthcoming about the role of her spouse. If her spouse, for example, chose option A, that they would just be a first spouse and have no official duties, then Dan Little could live at Mahonia Hall and they could have security detail as provided. But if her spouse decided to have a policy setting agenda and be a part of that administration, say for the purpose of making sure every Oregon child has a toothbrush and gets their teeth cleaned, then the spouse can go and do that work. They cannot, under this bill, could not be paid in the private sector to do this work in a companion role. And should every child in Oregon then get a toothbrush, then we would actually have a situation where the governor's spouse under House Bill 3043 could not be paid by Crest Toothpaste or somebody who sells toothbrushes or does dental hygiene work for a period of 180 days, similar to how we can't go out and be lobbyists for a year. Lastly, a spouse under this bill cannot be employed in any other part of the executive branch, and they shall not be paid by the executive branch for any policymaking or agenda-setting roles. So how is this different than the bill that Governor Brown has brought forward? Governor Brown's proposed legislation takes the step of making the spouse a public official and takes off the table only income-producing opportunities that involve public speaking payments. Now, while she said to us on the dais as she was sworn in that her spouse is not going to make any income and that they're not going to leverage this for public or for personal gain, and I believe her and take her at her word, the bill as she has drafted it doesn't do what she actually told us she was interested in doing. It does not address the bigger concerns about access to the governor and other means by which a governor's spouse earns income or could be perceived as opening doors to the governor in exchange for payment. House Bill 3043 creates a clear path for the governor, his or her spouse, and increases transparency for the public. It also removes the gray areas of the law and provides certainty to the governor's staff, who, in the case of Kitzhaber and Hayes, and probably also in the case in Virginia, tried to walk a line, but they didn't know where the line was, and if the line moved, there was nothing in the law to back up their concerns for the activity of Governor Kitzhaber and his fiancée. This bill cleans all of that up and provides surety for both the governor, their staff, and for the public.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, Representative, thank you. I appreciate these. My impression over the past couple of years is that increasingly we find testimony a bit fast and loose in some of these committees, so I appreciate that. And also the comprehensive nature of 3043. Appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Representative Nose.
I have a question and kind of an observation. So is the governor's bill that you're referring to, Representative Parrish, is that 2020?
No, I think that is the Senate bill. It's a Senate bill.
I might not have that in front of me, so you indulge me just a second. I'm wondering if House Bill 2020 would be something you'd be willing to consider. It's a bill sponsored by most of our legislative leadership, and I think it's a little cleaner because it doesn't sort of have a checklist of things that you know, if you do this, then that, but it just sort of says, yes, the first spouse is an elected official. Public official, sorry. And it just sort of subjects you to the ethics process, period, end of discussion, and just says, I guess if I could just, like in my house, my husband at first really acted like he didn't have any interest in what was going on around here. He was sick of it. But every other day now, something in the newspaper jogs his interest or piques his mind, or he wonders why we're doing this, and it's just organic, mm-hmm. right? It just, and I would argue that he is influencing me in some way, though I will not vote for self-serve gasoline. So you see what I'm saying here, which is like, I wonder if like House Bill 2020 just is acknowledges what happens in a relationship, which is people are going to talk. That's just normal. And I can't draw a clear, bright line about where he's doing it for pay and lobbying. Let's just say he's the spouse and acknowledge that that exists and just fill out the ethics form. So that's one thing. I just ask you to think about that. And then the other I would observe is that in both of these bills, they refer to spouse, partner. I think neither of them cover the situation that we are sort of all talking about, because I believe technically the governor, I can't think of what the right word is, I'll use fiancé, they weren't technically married.
Chair Hoyle.
They wouldn't be covered, right? They weren't in a legal status that I think is described in either of these bills. That's just my observation.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Nose, you're absolutely right in that the governor wasn't married, and under the current rules, that was where the gray line and the clear bright line doesn't exist. House Bill 3043, I said in the beginning of the testimony, and I do talk fast, and I appreciate that, but did say that we have historical precedent for where a first, lady, in the case of that, it was the Times, was not a marital relative. 3043 allows for that. It basically says that if Governor Kate Brown wanted to designate you as with these duties, she could walk in. You didn't have to be married. You don't even have to live under the same roof. But she has the ability to designate somebody into that role by within 72 hours, has to acknowledge who that person is, and then go and attest that that person is somebody who is going to have a role. And to the point about whether I would support 2020, I would support 2020 if that's indeed the one we're talking about with the spouse bill that says that they're a public official. But I actually just don't think that covers the scenarios that we've just seen in Oregon and in Virginia of sort of the what I would describe as influence peddling. The public official piece doesn't really get us there. And this, I think, does. And it actually sets some clear definitions. It doesn't actually feel as onerous as it you might think, because once you've made that election, you make that election sort of once every 4 years or any time it changes. So it's sort of a one-time deal at the upfront of being sworn in as a governor.
Chair, I just worry it's be hard to enforce.
Thank you. And what I would like to say is I very much like and support ensuring that the conflicts of interest are dealt with in a quick manner by the Ethics Commission. My one bit of feedback and where I'd like to see us expand this further goes to my vice chair's concern, which is if we're going to make laws that affect the governor or the executive branch, I think that we should also adhere to those laws as well as possible. So I'd like to see the bill relating to conflict of interest apply to legislators and all electeds as well, understanding that some electeds, some legislators have family members that do work in their offices, and completely appropriate. We'd have to look at that. But again, if we're going to look at something, the relating clause on your bill is relating to the governor of the state of Oregon, and I think if we could look at a different bill to put some of these things specifically making this process more expeditious, that would be good, but it would need to be a different bill with a different relating clause.
Chair Hoyle, I appreciate that, and I'm willing to lift up this type of language and apply it to anybody we need to apply it to. So if that means the speaker has the purview to release a bill that could come to rules as a committee bill, I'm completely fine with that, and we take a lot of sort of the same process. The slight difference for, an AG or even a legislator is that while there might be 90 of us and the AG doesn't sign off on policy at all, they certainly have a different type of role. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, the governor is the person who gets the veto up or down on any legislation that any of the 90 of us bring forward. So it is a little bit more uniquely different. However, like I said, I would like to take the language if you want to bring back a committee bill and drop it all in and mash it up together and apply it out to everybody. Happy to do that.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to have to move to the next bill, which is House Bill 3505. And I will close the hearing on House Bill 2790, 2791, and 3043, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3505. And there are a lot of people here to testify on this bill, so if I could ask you to keep your testimony succinct, although informative, that would be fantastic.
And can do. So, Madam Chair, again, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, and glad to bring you a bill that actually has the legislature wrapped in. So anybody who wants to do that will certainly get a little bit of that in this bill. House Bill 3505 is really designed to try to get at what I've seen as being the stonewalling of public records. It's a problem at every level of government, so this is not just directed at the executive branch, but we've seen that the recent abuse of the process has been clearly highlighted in the issues surrounding Governor Kitzhaber's resignation. In fact, I asked a media outlet today, what's the oldest outstanding record that you request that you still have that has yet been unmet? And it was from August of last year, and it is almost May of this year. Nearly a year after the first records requests were in place, there's a lot of outstanding requests. I appreciate Governor Brown released 94,000 emails transacted by Governor Kitzhaber's fiance, but it certainly doesn't cover all the requests that have been made. This issue happens at all levels of government, from water boards and city councils to county commissions and state agencies. Of note, exemption from public records requests while legislators are in session is problematic as well. Time is not the only barrier of a records request. Reasonable fees, which is what the current language of the law says, that a governing body can charge are inconsistent across the board, and sometimes fees are used as a weapon to stop records requests. If, for example, a local government assesses a reasonable fee of $1,300 for a records request, there's nothing reasonable about that, and depending on who's asking for the record, $1,300 can be so prohibitive that the record request goes unmet. That was a real fee that was charged to Channel 6 KOIN. For one record. Further, in today's digital environment, we're losing the public records as they are being created on personal devices and social media platforms. So the solution in House Bill 3505 is designed to increase transparency and end the practice of stonewalling the public with time delays or outrageous fees associated with public records requests. It will provide consistency for the public and ensure that the work we do in the digital record is preserved. So what the bill does, 3505 requires a minimum 3-year retention schedule for all public bodies, including the legislature. Some agencies are already doing this. Some actually even go further. But at a minimum, I believe, and in fact, I believe the executive branch has a permanent retention schedule for the governor's office. However, no place is this more egregious than our own legislative body. House rules provide that we only have to retain for 1 year, and what is retained is based on individual preferences of the individual legislator. Given that we on the House side are elected in 2-year terms and voters voted us annual sessions in 2010, it makes no sense that our record retention schedule is only 1 year. 3 years attempts to get us through an entire biennium and covers the cooling off period we have following an exit from the legislature, where we have a year before being eligible to be a lobbyist, should any of us choose to go do that. It would stand to reason that our own records should be available after a transition from this body, particularly if a legislator is going to move on to an agency or do other political work. Next, the bill addresses the response time. Currently, many records requesters make a request and the request is seemingly ignored. In fact, I've talked to members of the press and the public who've shared that when they make a request, they can go weeks before a receipt of the request is even acknowledged. And that House Bill 3505 requires an initial response of a receipt within 7 days, and then the clock starts on the request. If the initial response doesn't return of the public record immediately, then the public body is required to give status reports until the record has been returned over to the requester. If there are exemptions that the public body is going to claim, then the response shall include the rationale for those exemptions. And folks, there's over 400 exemptions currently in the law. So it's clear that the requester that what they are going to receive in the response to the request is fulfilled. If after 3 weeks the request has not been fulfilled to the requester, 3505 requires that public body forgo any materials costs associated with the request. If after 6 weeks the request has not been met, then the public body's inability to produce the documents requested shall be presumed to be a denial of the request. There is a process for when a petitioner believes the public record has been denied, but this puts a hard timeline on it, and that process is outlined elsewhere in statute already. In the current statutes, a public body may make reasonable fees requested to the person who is asking for the record. As written, the current language is where the fee actually becomes unreasonable. It allows for staff time, not just for material costs. Nothing in our current laws anywhere would require that we charge the public at all for these requests. So, mind you, there's nothing that says we actually have to charge people.
Representative Parrish, I don't know if this is written testimony, but I've got a number of people for
it's not written
over, over 100 miles away. So if we could wrap up your testimony, because you've been given a lot of time, and I appreciate this, but you are welcome to submit written testimony. But
and I can certainly do that for you. Effectively, I will be happy to send this, into you, Madam Chair. You know, you're going to hear from cities and counties today who are going to put forward a lot of objections about why this is hard and why this is difficult. I will say that in 2010, this body was offered the ability to use a software program that the Secretary of State makes available called TRIM. It would allow any of us who are public records creators to immediately put our things out into the public square and make them available. So the arguments today that you're going to hear about how difficult this is, if we had the Secretary of State's archivist here, I think she could negate pretty quickly how difficult the terms of House Bill 3505 are, that they could actually be done. And so this is different than the governor's proposal, I will say that. The governor's proposal requests an audit. It only requests the agencies. It does not include any other local bodies. It does not include the legislature or the judicial branch of government. So I appreciate that Governor Brown is looking at this through her auditor's eye, but we know what the real problems are with public records. It's the stonewalling of time and fees and not giving the data to the public. You'll also hear from some of the cities and counties today about what a nuisance some of these requests are, and that there are people who are prolific records requesters, and that they are, I've heard them described as obnoxious. I've heard them described as pains in backsides, except those weren't quite the words that people use to describe them, and that they really just don't want to have to deal with these people. Folks, they are taxpayers, and I would maintain that the records were created with public dollars. They're being retained with public dollars, so to ask the public then to pay for them after we already did is absolutely unreasonable to me. Lastly, this is the real reason I believe the bill is needed. Our Constitution provides that we have both free speech and a free press. I believe that was designed purposefully so that we might be able to have the press keep an eye on our government. The press has the ability to widely disseminate information about the government to the people. When the function of the Constitution that allows the press to communicate the workings of our government to the people becomes relegated as a business decision by the press to whether or not they're going to even report a story, if the bill of literally one public news or one newspaper, a bill from Metro on some elephant stuff going on at the zoo.
1 minute, Representative Parrish.
That's fine. Is $20,000 to one newspaper for bills about, public records about elephants at the zoo? That's a problem. If that becomes the decision point from how they report the news, is that, and you'll hear other people today talk about how much fees they've been charged. If that's the decision point, folks, we're losing our democracy, and House Bill 3505 seeks to address that problem. I'll take questions, but I know there's a lot of people who want to testify on either side of this issue.
And yes.
I will submit my written
Representative design. Rayfield, quick question, quick answer.
Yeah, and I'm one of the annoying people that act for counties that actually does the public records requests, and what I would note is I generally do 30-plus requests as I go through something as I'm trying. This could be videos. This can be text messages. I mean, it scans through all different types of emails addressing to and from, call logs, you name it. What I can tell you is the fact that when I do this, say, to a county or a sheriff's department, it sometimes requires them to pull in other deputies who, quite frank, because there's not a lot of money in these counties to perform this. And what I can tell you is in 3 weeks, even as a requester, I know they can't comply within 3 weeks. And generally, sometimes it will take even up to 90 days for them to have the ability with the limited resources they have. Is there any modifications to this that you've considered to kind of address some rural counties that don't have the resources to comply within these timeframes?
Chair Royal, Rep. Rayfield, I think the answer lies in using the tool that's available by the Secretary of State. You can get that down to $10 per user per month.
And what I would also note is, and just follow up really quickly, you can't use a document when you hand information out through a public record request. An attorney has to review that information. Other people have to review whether it is related or not related, and there is a big time sink when you're actually doing that. It's not a matter of simply making it available. There has to be hours put into reviewing those documents that you're submitting out, because there are various exemptions that have to be reviewed.
That's right. And Representative Rayfield, the TRIM software actually lets you, as the public records creator, put those levels of threshold. So a level one, for example, is you can have some guy sitting on his recliner all night on a Saturday searching everything that you said here's available in the public square. And then it goes into like a level two, three, and four, where you would still have to go do that. But that initial search could be done for by the individual. And then they could come back to you and say, hey, I see that this document's available. I'd like that document specifically. And please redact whatever you need to redact. I mean, this is not a referendum on how many redactions that we have. I think we have too many. But, you know, level four, for example, prison blueprints, probably not something you're going to put out in the public square, but at least you know the record exists, and then you can go have the conversation about asking for that record.
I wish it was that simple.
So. All right. Thank you. Thanks. Very much. With that, I am going to call up Bill Johnston, Mark Landauer, Morgan Allen. And if I know many of you have submitted written testimony, and I very much appreciate that. If you've submitted written testimony, please just summarize what you put in writing, make those key points, as we've been left with very little time for public testimony. But thank you very much for being here. Whoever wants to start.
Yeah, I'll start out. I was going to say good afternoon, but I'll say this evening. So.
Thanks.
Chair Hoyle and the committee, I'm Bill Johnstone, President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and I'm happy to be here this evening to speak on behalf of more than 200 radio and television stations across the state of Oregon that are members of the OAB. And as members of the media, we serve an essential role in serving the public and providing a watchdog role as the lady legislator. Spoke to earlier, but I am here to speak of some challenges. Many of those challenges she included in her testimony prior to, so some of it is going to be duplicate. We reviewed many of the stations across the state, and the collective information that we received from them showed us that there's a lack of consistency across the agencies, a lack of knowledge on how to fulfill a request for records, and a seemingly arbitrary opinion and position on pricing. Even though we have selected just a few, I think you'll get the idea. Recently, one of the television stations requested the same information from three public agencies, the Secretary of State, Department of Administrative Services, and the Governor's Office. The request was made on April the 8th of this year. Secretary of State's office fulfilled the request within 3 days. DAS and the Governor's office have not, as yet, even acknowledged the receipt of the request or provided us a time frame as when we might receive that information. Another station had a legal battle with TriMet over security camera maintenance records, which lasted nearly 3 months. This required a court battle and with the help of our congressional delegation before the station was finally given the records. A station in Central Oregon ended up having to take the city of Prineville to court when the city refused to release documentation and reports regarding why it had fired the police chief. The station finally won the case and the litigation process, but still took nearly 2 months. Further, there was an example of a station in Portland where they cost $17,000 for the health records regarding the elephant program of the Oregon Zoo. $4,850 for the Oregon State Police Trooper crash records and $3,930 for Portland Police crash records. $12,000 for Reynolds High School shooting case from Troutdale. $1.5 million for public records about Mayor Sam Adams' office in the city of Portland. And $9,000 for emails regarding the Right to Dream 2 camp from the city of Portland. And it is important to add, though, however, that the city finally issued an apology to the station, and they ended up paying $122 for that $9,000 email. Public records request has become a financial business decision for many, many stations, and because of the cost, many of the stations have to determine if the money that they're going to pay, the $17,000, the $9,000, whatever it happens to be, is it worth getting information that ultimately they may not be able to use? So what it boils down to is sometimes the stations don't do the news reporting that they need to get done because they financially can't afford the money to get the records from that particular agency. So whether it's a small community like Prineville or a major metropolitan like Portland, it's vital for the government to meet its responsibility to issue materials in public records requests in a timely manner. It should be part of the commitment to transparency. Government officials in all agencies should be aware of public record statutes, including the presumption that a record is public unless there is a specific exemption allowing it to be private. Train on how to properly fulfill a request, and most importantly, understand that a government's employee's personal agenda is not and cannot be a part of the process of fulfillment. As journalists, we have both the right and the responsibility to seek information as stewards to the public. It's logical for us to expect government agencies to act professionally in delivering materials as part of the public's right to know. I thank you for your consideration and your time today. I realize that we're running very late, and I would take questions if you'd like me to.
Well, we'll get through the panel, and thank you very much. That was very helpful. Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. We do have some concerns with the bill as currently drafted and oppose it. In the interest of time, I'll sum up. Our primary concern is really around the timelines. I think the bill starts out on a good note. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that you get at least an acknowledgement as someone who's filled public records requests. It was always my policy to try to do that within 48 hours and let the folks know that you've gotten the request. But we have some big concerns. Essentially, the bill says if you don't fill the request in 3 weeks, it's free. If you don't fill it within 6 weeks, essentially you're in trouble potentially with attorney's fees and other costs. And I think the uniqueness of the school calendar as compared to some of the other local governments or the legislature, we have vacations, Christmas vacation, summer vacation when many of our staff are off or our districts are effectively shut down. So, you know, perhaps an example would be is if you got a public records request on a Thursday or Friday before Christmas break, you know, the clock is ticking, but potentially no one's there to see that or start work on that for a couple weeks. So we have some concerns about those timelines. I think we also have some concerns about the timelines. Of our 197 school districts, 120 of them have fewer than 1,000 students. 90 of them have fewer than 500 students, which means that oftentimes the folks doing those public records requests or filling those records requests, unlike in our large districts that may have communication staff, you've got principals or administrators trying to, or school secretaries trying to fulfill those public records requests. And if there are time limits, essentially you're saying filling public records requests is the most important thing you do. It moves that work to the front of the line compared to the other work that our school staff are doing. And I'd put it a little bit nicer. Sometimes we do have citizens that get a little bee in their bonnet about public records or things going on in school districts. You know, you can imagine if a school is being closed or something like that, someone might be upset about that. But essentially, with timelines and the parameters in the bill, it wouldn't be very hard for a citizen to really grind a small school district's daily activities to a halt with continued public records requests. So we support the idea of open and transparent government. But we think that potentially prioritizing public records requests over the other work of school districts is problematic. Thank you.
Chair. Mr. Landauer.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Landauer here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 950 local governments, providing a variety of services to the citizens of Oregon, including fire, parks, libraries, water, sewer, vector control. There's even a weather control district in the state of Oregon, although I doubt it's active. We too very much support the transparency of public records. It creates trust with the citizens that we serve. However, House Bill 3505 raises a number of concerns for our members, and Representative Parrish outlined many of those for us. With that being said, we too also have a number of districts that do not have any full-time employees. As a matter of fact, many of our districts don't have an employee. They are run by volunteers in some cases. The Port of Nehalem meets once a month, Many of our districts throughout the state meet just once a month, and in fact, some just meet once a year. Needless to say, if that is in fact the case and the timelines brought forward by this measure, we will be in violation of it every single time, particularly for a drainage district that may meet just once a year. Furthermore, we have, and there are instances where we would have fire crews on fighting a forest fire for weeks on end. We will probably be experiencing that this summer with all hands on deck, so to speak, with nobody receiving the mail and receiving public records requests. So the timelines for us are very problematic, particularly for the small rural entities. And please be reminded that when somebody makes a public records request, as the representative stated, there are over 400 exemptions to the public records disclosure. We have to review those records that are being requested in order to ensure that they are compliant, once they are released, compliant with not disclosing some of the 400 exemptions that you as a legislative body have created in the first place. So with that, and in the interest of time, thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Comments? Okay, next up, Lee Vandervoo, Alex Kyler, and Dave Reinhart. And again, I apologize for the shortness of time, but if you have written testimony, please keep your testimony brief, but let us know what you've come here to say. Ma'am.
Thoank you. My name's Lee Vandervoo. I'm a reporter here in Oregon. I don't usually speak in public, so bear with me. I haven't been to Toastmasters. I did submit written testimony. I'll trust that you'll all read it. I just want to respond to some of the comments that I've heard over the last few minutes. Of course, as a member of the press, we're very sympathetic to some of the smaller districts that we have in our state of Oregon that aren't able to adhere to these timelines as easily as some of our larger jurisdictions. The problem is this is the area of the law that just cost us, I think, the scandal that we had with our governor. I don't think that John Kitzhaber would have been our governor if we had had an earlier opportunity to understand the questions that were raised about his conduct in office. And as Rep. Parrish mentioned, the earliest records request related to or seeking those types of disclosures were from, I have July 2014. She said August 2014. I'm not sure which is correct, but either one is quite a long time ago. Had we had that information at that time, I really think we would have had a different kind of election. And I don't think we can say now, after we've had a governor leave office and now we're all living in a state where the person who is our governor was not an elected governor, that we should do nothing about this because we have so many small jurisdictions that it wouldn't be fair to them. I'm sure there's some kind of equitable solution for these smaller jurisdictions that hopefully we can work out. But honestly, just having a 7-day, we got your request response, I think would be a wonderful starting point. I have provided you with testimony from the 2010 Transparency Initiative led by Attorney General John Kroger. I led a work group at that time on behalf of Society of Professional Journalists that gathered more than 110 pages of examples from Oregon newsrooms showing that foot dragging in response to public records law is a very significant problem, as are obstructive costs. I hope that you will read those, and that is all I have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Kyler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. You do have my testimony on OLIS, so I'll just summarize. We do not support this bill as introduced for many of the reasons that Representative Parrish predicted we would say. We would incur new costs. The timelines, in our view, actually present an incentive for there to be the necessary delay such that we are unable to charge the fee to recoup our expenses. And finally, I just point out that I think one of the issues is that in a
organization. We have 1,500 employees. The bill still doesn't identify to whom the public records request shall be made. And you talked a little bit about exploring a way to have consistent fees across the state of Oregon. It would be nice if there was a consistent person that would be identified as the person who would process these. That might be an improvement for the bill. Clearly, that would incur some expense, and as my testimony indicates, we find no appropriation in the bill to cover any of the expenses associated with it. Thank you.
Dave Reinhardt, representing Linn County, here today. I've submitted testimony, and I will try to be brief. We just find this terribly unrealistic in its provisions. It will increase our costs and lead to litigation that will in turn increase our costs. We think it is an overreaction to what has recently happened, the recent unpleasantness in Oregon. If this is, I don't know whether this is a matter of locking up the barn door after your prize stallion and his mare have left, but it certainly is a case of punishing the poor horses that remain behind. And we just urge you to amend the counties out of this, amend local governments out, if you were even going to go forward with this.
Thank you, and thank you for your eloquent metaphor. Yes. Quote, yes, Representative Rayfield.
I just had a quick question. I think it's really important to note that, you know, I write public records requests, and I find it very important to have access to this information. I just want to find a workable solution to get there. One of the concerns that, as you guys were talking, that that I thought about was if one of the Linn County specifically, if you were submitted 100 public requests on one day, fairly comprehensive scope to be able to do that, and you were talking about an incentive almost to flood the system with public records requests, because then you know your public records requests could be free at the end of the day and you wouldn't get compensated for all that time, yet the entire staff would be, I mean, is that kind of what you're talking about?
That's one of the issues, certainly, and I think it just bears a lot of discussion, and Lord knows I don't think anybody wants to recommend another task force on this, but it should be done with due deliberation and consultation.
Agreed. Thank you very much. With that, Daryl Flood, John Wood, and Jeb Bladline. Mispronounce your name, I'll just apologize. Who would like to start?
Okay. Chair Hoyle, my name is John Wood. I'm from the Dalles. For the record, I'm from the Dalles in Wasco County. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify for House Bill 3505. House Bill 3505 starts to address the statewide problem of ethics, record retention, and access to public records. To cut to the chase, in the information that I've given you, our district attorney did a summation of a public records request by Charles McHenry. He submitted a request on October 10th of two things. First, for the emails of Commissioner Rod Runyon, containing the words campaign, contribution, and donation, and second, for the emails between Commissioner Runyon and Commissioner Scott Hagee during a specific period of time. The county responded on November 5th, the day after the elections, and 26 days after the request was received. They said it would cost 25 cents per electronic page for $503 for the information. It was going to take 3 hours of IT time at $120 an hour for $360, and 8 hours of legal time at $40 an hour for $320, bringing the total to $1,183. Mr. McHenry, on November 10th, requested our DA to review the request, and his summation was the county can only charge $15 for the electronic disc provided that had all the information on it, and the IT time was actually less than 1 hour. So the county ordinance only said that they could only charge $40 for that 1 hour. So instead of a cost of $1,183, $183. It was only $55. The DA had his order. He instructed the county to provide the documents without delay. And so Mr. McHenry received the documents 2 months after his request. The DA also added that after reading the emails, it appeared our commissioners deliberated on county matters. Under public meeting laws, Appendix J, it says commissions of three cannot have any contact, personal, phone, or electronic, outside of public meetings in regards to deliberating on government business, because two makes a quorum. That brings me to the issue I'm involved in. In the last 6 years, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum County have formed a tri-county health district to serve all three counties to improve services and to control costs. On December 17th, Wasco County Commissioners at a Wasco County Commission meeting, Commissioner Kramer moved to separate Wasco County from the Tri-County Health District. It was seconded and voted on and passed unanimously with no deliberation or public input. This was a shock and surprise to most of Wasco County. The commissioners didn't put separating from the health district on the agenda as required by public meeting laws. A group of us citizens did a public records request, and we've been charged $600 for it, for the emails prior to the health district deliberation or decision. We found out they'd been deliberating on the health district for 2 weeks outside of public meetings. The Dallas Chronicle asked Commissioner Kramer why it wasn't put on the agenda, and he said, because I don't have to. The commissioners made a $340,000 decision with no public input or financial analysis of any kind. We tried to mediate with the commissioners, but they pretty much just stonewalled us, knowing we only had 60 days to file a lawsuit. I filed a lawsuit asking them to void the health district decision, pay my attorney fees, and make a statement saying they would follow all public meeting laws in the future. As part of the lawsuit, we did a request for production of documents, all the emails between the commissioners for the last 2 years. We were in search of more cases of deliberation outside of public meetings. First, the county's only emails are only saved for 1 year. And second, they wanted to charge me $25,000 for the public records request. For the production of documents request. Then we did a public records request for the same information, and they wouldn't start that until I made a deposit of $10,000. Since our commissioners were elected 4 years ago, they have mentioned many times about the need for transparency in our government, but they are more opaque than transparent. Actions speak louder than words. As of April 16th, our commissioners voted to add lawyer fees to all public records requests. The person doing the requesting will get an estimate of lawyer fees before the request is started to see if they can afford it. I laid before you a pattern of public meeting violations and attempts to prevent public access to records. House Bill 3505 will help keep government records transparent so Oregonians can request public information without the fear of financial hardship. I made a decision to liquidate my retirement, part of my retirement, to pay these fees and my lawyer's fees. House Bill 3505 gives Oregon's affordable, timely access to public records. Thank you.
Thank you for coming here today. Sir.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Jeb Bladin. I'm publisher of the News Register in McMinnville, but I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I'm not here to talk about specifics of House Bill 3505. I've been asked to talk briefly, very briefly, about the importance of why we need changes in general in Oregon's public records laws. I became editor the year that our public records law took effect, so I've never had a journalistic life without that law in place. I can only imagine what it would have been without that. But over those 40 years, I've watched every single exemption added to this law, as well as many other changes. I provided a handout, which I don't know that you have or not, but it's a handout that is purely illustrative of these exemptions. It lists all the exemptions of ORS 192. I'm not suggesting you read all those, but I hope that it makes the point of the extent of those exemptions. The number of exemptions that we have are every one of them is an invitation to delay, an invitation to deny, an invitation to overcharge. There's excessive analysis, there are excessive fees, and there are unjustified denials of public records based on these exemptions and the timing and the fees that they spawn. In response to some other testimony you had, it's very important to understand, I believe, that the secrecy, the denial of records is by choice. It's not mandatory. In almost all cases, the exemptions in Oregon's public records are permissive, not mandatory. Since the government chooses the secrecy and is available to, you know, it can release these documents at its choice, we believe that the government should pay the primary cost of the analysis and the primary cost of the separation of the records that it chooses to withhold. The public records laws in Oregon were created after Watergate, just as they were throughout the country, but ever since, transparency has deteriorated in the state, as we've seen through the growth of this law. We at ONPA hope that this group and others in the legislature will start to reverse the pendulum using this bill and other bills to begin the work of returning Oregon statutes to their original status as a statutory window into government in Oregon.
Thank you very much, sir.
My name is Darrell Flood, and I'm here representing citizens' rights to access to public information across the state. I've been working on this effort for more than 8 years. If I come across offensive to you, I apologize now. This may be just another piece of legislation for you. This is personal for me. For 8 years, I've tried to get this topic heard in this forum. I have been both pacified and ignored by my local representatives. I would like to thank you for your service to our state. It is appreciated. Trust in one government is a valuable thing. Unfortunately, there are actions and inactions that create and foster mistrust. You have an opportunity to fix this. This is where you get to make a difference. This cannot be about one high-profile specific incident. The perversion of access to information has gone on far too long and is system-wide. System-wide. Transparency. A word that has been so manipulated and abused has become irrelevant. Advocates now use the word sunlight. When the lights get turned on, the cockroaches scatter. It is fantastic that the public records is finally getting a formal conversation today. Up to this point, the actions regarding public records access has been minimal and in the wrong direction. Many organizations and agencies have come and usurped a citizen's right to information. We've heard from some today. They have passively and actively lobbied against disclosure. They hide behind outrageous fees, deflection, sleight of hand, circus tricks. They have created a state of fear among public officials. They teach government agencies how to block records and mistreat the public that wants and needs the information. They encourage and provide a platform for name-calling of the interested, referring to them as those people. I am one of those people, just like you. I request records, just like you. I am here to ask you to open the doors and windows on public records. Let them breathe and be seen in the sunlight. Use words like open documents and disclosure. Refuse to allow entities to control people by controlling the information. You will hear comments and excuses from opponents of disclosure. They will say that government doesn't have the resources or the time or that it's expensive. They will claim that people will stall the agency's work with over-demand. We've heard that today. They will make statements against you for doubting their motives. It is sad that Oregon continues to lag behind the rest of the country and the federal government in making records available. It isn't just a lack of availability, it is a forceful stoppage by refusals to respond or immediate racking up of charges. The agencies laugh and joke about their ability to cause records requests to fail. They share strategies and warn others when they perceive a threat to their sense of power or control of information. So now I need your help. When they come to you and claim that it is too cumbersome, I expect you to ask them how they managed to do it for free for their own staff, council, commissions, but not for the general public and media. When they come to tell you that the equipment is too expensive, I expect you to ask them why they aren't being more fiscally responsible in their purchases. When they start claiming actual charges, ask them if it's the $35,000 clerk or the $130,000 city manager fulfilling the request. When they tell you they just don't have the time to get the information, ask them how much time they are wasting circumventing the process. Included in the background packet I provided are examples from the OCCMA listserv postings. These highlight some of the conversations these agencies have had with each other and the anti-access advice given to its members. When we posted these messages from a tax-funded resource online, our access was immediately shut down. These are the people who are asking you to stop forward movement towards sunlight in this state. The packet also includes information regarding charges we have personally faced. One special incident was at the Department of Administrative Services when we were charged $81 just to find out if the document existed. This is unacceptable. While our preference is that all documents are online for free for all, we realize that forward movement is better than backward. This conversation cannot end at this hearing. Don't let this bill die an unnatural death. Information can change people's lives. Please move this bill forward. Think about how seriously the anti-sunlight lobbyists take the people who are footing the bill. There is no representation there. Let there be representation here. I know you can make a difference. It is better to err on the side of exposure than to continue in darkness. Thank you for your attention in this highly charged and important topic. Do you have any questions?
Does anyone have any questions of this panel or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, Eileen Stein, Scott Winkles, Karen Johnson. And again, if you have submitted written testimony, please summarize that written testimony. Again, I apologize for the lateness of the hour. We don't generally have legislators presenting their bills to take up as much time. So with that,
Chair,
Scott Winkles.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. And we are opposed to House Bill 3505 for the reasons you have heard. I will add one more that has not been mentioned. And it's important to note that the current status of the law is the result of a negotiated process that took place in 2007. I believe Mr. Landauer and I are the only two left who were part of that group that negotiated the current status of the records law. And the reason there's no hard timeline to return a record is that the group recognized that not all records requests are identical. So if you ask me for a one-page email that I sent yesterday, a reasonable timeline to return that is within the hour, if less. If you have a hard timeline of 3 weeks, not that I would, but I think you could make the case that you could return that single document in 3 weeks and sit on it during the length of the timeline. Cities don't get simple requests for emails, and with me today, we get requests for things about land use decisions involving parcels of property and maps that can be quite cumbersome. And with me today are two of Oregon City's recorders, Karen Johnson, and city manager from St. Helens, Eileen Stein. And if you want to take a look at how to improve transparency in the state, I would encourage you to spend some time with your local city recorders. And with that, I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you.
My name is Karen Johnson. I'm the city recorder for the City of Independence, Oregon. We're a mid-sized city, population 8,600. Of the 242 incorporated cities in Oregon, we're 57th in population, meaning that there's 185 cities smaller than I am. So my situation is not necessarily unique, but it is certainly shared by quite a few cities. The current law states that we provide records within a reasonable time. In my practice, I always attempt to give an answer that I can provide a document within 48 hours. That's not always possible, but that's what I strive to achieve. I always give them when I think I'm going to provide the document and how much I think it might cost. For this 7-day period and then a further 7-day and a further 7-day, I get to take vacation. I get to take 2 weeks vacation. So I'm the only person in my office who does records requests. While I'm on vacation, I ask maybe the payroll clerk or the court clerk or the utility billing clerk to help out with records requests. They aren't necessarily trained real well, but they will make the attempt. But really large requests, like Mr. Winkles talked about, land use planning, those are, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pages. We're talking about maps that are blueprint size. We are talking about things that are files that are this thick. That would have to wait till I return. So when I get back from my 2-week vacation, I'm already way behind the timeline. And then additionally, I'm not just the city recorder. I'm also the risk manager. And as such, I take care of liability claims and workers' comp issues. So those things would have to go by the wayside until I take care of this public records request because of this seven-day timeline. And you really need to be able to have that opportunity for us to be able to extend the timeline should it be needed. I heard mentioned by, I believe it was Representative Parrish talking about TRIM. TRIM is available to the cities, but at a cost, and it's not $10 per licensee. For a small city who would have fewer than 10 people, it's a minimum of over $300 a month, which might not be in our budgets. That also assumes that all records are digital, which ours are not. We provide a lot of our records in paper still. We are not in the digital age, and I can assure you that there's probably quite a few cities that are still that way as well. I don't refer to requesters as pain in the whatever piece of anatomy it is. They are citizens. I work for the citizens of the city of Independence.
Thank you for your testimony, and I want to apologize for anybody that questioned your integrity, your motive, or the dedication you bring to your job. Your city manager is the former city manager of Junction City, and he speaks incredibly highly of the staff there. So I apologize for that ill treatment, but thank you for being here and for laying out what some of the real challenges are. Ma'am.
Good afternoon, Eileen Stein. I am the city manager of Mount Angel, and I'm past president of the Oregon City Managers Association and a past member of the OAMR when I was city recorder in Springfield. I'm also a member of the League of Oregon Cities Board of Directors. I don't have written testimony, but I would encourage you to really read the letters of testimony that you received from the Oregon Association of Municipal Recorders. And other city recorders in the state. I'd also like to speak about the impact of this legislation on small cities. We are smaller than Prineville and smaller than Independence. There's 3,300 people on our staff in our city. Had to interject some humor. That would be great. I wouldn't be here. Yeah. 3,300 people in our city, and my assistant to the city manager also functions as our city recorder. He also functions as our city planner. So I'm thinking about this legislation, and I think there's some laudable pieces of this legislation, but I think about our city planner and my city recorder, the same person, who, if given a public records request, would have to decide whether to meet a statutory timeline for a land use application or a statutory timeline for issuing a public records request, and this is the same person. And so it really gets to be a matter of which state statute are we going to ignore in order to just get the work done. And I think that's really where things have gotten to. City recorders are a very diligent bunch, and they take public records requests very seriously. They are not stonewalling. They're simply caught in the middle of all of the requirements that had been placed on them. Many requests are responded to right away, but delayed requests are usually the result of large and voluminous requests for information, which take time to research. These are often for political purposes, and I don't mean party politics, I mean community politics, where somebody is filing a public records request to get at information about something or in response to some other party in the city. City recorders get caught in the middle of all of this, having to respond to these requests. I am aware of another city where, due to the daily and weekly public records request by a single few, means that city council meeting minutes are simply not getting done. They're weeks and months behind schedule, just producing city council meeting minutes. I would echo the comments by the Milwaukee City Recorder, Pat Duvall, who points out the same, including the potential, and depending on the timing of the request, that many other critical time-sensitive tasks, such as producing city council meeting packets and meeting election deadlines, could also be interrupted. The retention requirements in this bill will create significant burdens for space, workload, and budget. We, too, don't have all of our records digitized, and so oftentimes we are simply producing copies of documents, and to hold on to those for 3 years means that we're simply double-filing paper documents. A statutory dictate of what fees can be and the determination of an alternative method for determining fees, this is simply a violation of home rule authority and quite an intrusion into the very minute business of a city council setting public records fees and other fees just to recover costs. These are just some quick observations in this bill. Again, please take the time to review the testimony provided by OAMR and the other city recorders. And please take the time to consider the impacts of this legislation on units of local government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I will call up Commissioner Jim Bernard, and apologies for not calling you earlier. You're kind of over to my right, and I should have called you up. First, yes, most people are over to my right, aren't they? So Commissioner Bernard, Rob Bavette, and Kristen Campbell from Wasco County.
I guess I'll get started since the time is late. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk on this bill. Public records requests are a very important avenue for the public to get access to actions by commissioners and city councils. There are many good intentions in the bill. However, we think that public records requests should be affordable, sometimes not at the cost of taxpayers. We get many requests that are massive, and that one person making that request is probably spending their taxes over and over and over again. House Bill 3505 has three primary problems. It considers a fee cap to limit the cost of requesting without considering the cost. Second, it creates restrictive timeline provided requests without considering the volume. And third, the bill does not take into consideration the future of public records requests, namely use of body cameras. Clackamas County receives a high volume every year. It's not uncommon for these requests to be broad in scope, which creates additional work for staff, requiring additional time to ensure complying with the request. If the requester is not paying for these public records, then the funds will have to come from the general fund, which are already constrained. While it may not be the intention of the bill, however, we believe that if a person is not paying for these requests, then there's likely to be an increase in volume for the requests. Higher volume unfunded requests is a burden to public body seeking to be fiscally responsible. In short, having a set of fees for retrieving public records will pose the same problem. For those who know me, I spend a lot of time for public safety. Our concern is a request for body cam. We have to blur out people who are not involved in that. That's going to take time and money, and storage capacity is massive. These requests will require the same amount of work that already takes place, but not include the next step, digital video editing. This is one tiny glimpse of the future. I can't stress enough how Clackamas County supports government transparency, and the access to public records should be affordable. And I think you heard some stories that are very unusual and not common for neither counties or cities. So while this bill has some great ideas, we urge you to oppose House Bill 3505. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Mr. Babette.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Babette, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, who also opposes the bill as written. I will be incredibly brief. I'm just going to call your attention to two documents you have in the record. One is my written testimony. It basically consists of I made a request to the Oregon Association of County Councils to give me real examples of real public records requests and how that would be processed under a 3505 environment, and I encourage you to read that. But even more, I encourage you to read the three-page letter from the Department of Administrative Services, STAS. It, in a real short three-page summary, it points out all the problems with 3505. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ma'am.
I'm Kristen Campbell. Our office is part-time outside counsel to Wasco County. You previously heard the testimony of one of our citizens, Mr. Wood. In short, I do dispute much of the testimony of Mr. Wood as simply inaccurate or without context. In the interest of time, however, I intend to submit written testimony unless there are specific questions right now, which I would be happy to address.
Questions? No, go ahead.
Sorry, I mean, I'll read your testimony.
Okay.
If you have a question. Okay. I want to say thank you very much for coming, and I very much appreciate it and appreciate the work you do.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, Amber Mathiason, again, let me know if I mispronounced your name. Amber. Fantastic. And Aaron Knott, Nathan Sykes. Aaron is gone, but Nathan, you're it. So bat and cleanup, make it quick.
I will make it quick.
But say everything you need to say.
Okay. Thank you. Nathan Sykes, Deputy Metro Attorney at Metro. First of all, I just want to start out by saying that Metro strongly supports the intent of the public records law. We believe the public has the right to information about operations and policies, and we're rigorous and diligent in responding to these requests in a timely fashion. We know that these high-profile public records issues have brought us here today, but we think that this bill is certainly not the way to go about it. I think everybody's talked about the timeline issues. We agree with the timeline issues. We have received public records requests at the zoo, which I believe have been mentioned today. I've submitted written testimony detailing every issue that I have with this bill. I will summarize a few of them. I do want to respond to the issue on the public records request for the zoo. I believe that record request was for every single record having to do with the elephants ever. Every single elephant, every medical record, every notation, every issue that we've ever had with the elephants, I think is what that request was for. So we did respond with how much time that would take us. One of the things I would like to point out that others haven't pointed out in this bill besides the timelines is there is a mandate in here that requires obligations on governments to retain text, social media, and email from non-governmental users. And I don't think anybody has brought up that issue yet. And I think that is an extremely hard burden on the governments to have to go through people's text, emails, and social media and have to put those on a server within 30 days. It also allows the AG to have civil penalties against the individual public servants for these if these are not put on within 30 days. So I would ask that you look at those and my testimony in the bill around texts. There's a subtle distinction in the portion around the payment of fees, which if you look at it and read it carefully, it provides that you only can pay the lesser of the actual amounts or the administrative fees. So what it really does is it forecloses the ability to get administrative fees at all. It really says in there you have to get the lesser of either 5 cents a copy or any administrative fees. So I think it essentially forecloses the ability to get any administrative fees out of as a public government asking for payment for fees for the work that you do. Beyond that, I would, again, the retention requirements, I would look at those very carefully. I think adding a one-size-fit-all retention requirement on all these governments will require us all to change our retention schedules. It would make us all go back to the archivist and required to redo our schedule with them, and the archivist to revise, actually, its Oregon administrative rules if you're to do that. So with that, I will wrap up. I know you've been under fire. We've been listening to this for a long time. I hope you read my comments, and if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to respond to those, and thank you for your time.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sykes, I'm concerned about the partisan nature of your testimony, and I'm wondering if you've ever received a request for donkey.
I can get back to you, Chair Hoyle, Chair Gilliam. I will find that out for you, and I can certainly get that information to you.
I want to thank you very much for your testimony, and I want to thank everybody for waiting. I think, you know, as we heard people talk, I think there are some clear and important issues that we need to address in transparency, specifically the lack of consistency in response, time, and cost. But what I've heard clearly is that a one-size-fits-all approach, and the 7-day limit seems like something that would be impossible in many cases to adhere to. And but we will come back. We will look at this. I'd like to put together, you know, something for all of these ethics bills that is comprehensive, constitutional, bipartisan, and not put forward in a punitive way, in that we really do appreciate the work that people have done, and we appreciate the citizens that are looking to get access to public documents, both very, very important. And I know it, people are doing their best, and we will come back and do something, but we'll be hearing another slate of ethics bills, and I look forward to working on all of these and having a good final product. Okay, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3505. Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, I would just like to ask on the record, I don't want to delay us anymore, but Dexter alleged counsel, I'm going to have some questions for you about House Bills 2790 and 2791 and whether committee chairs already have the ability to put witnesses under
oath. I actually would have to open that public hearing again.
Okay.
And,
okay. Can I submit a question?
Why don't we submit question in writing and then put it on the record, I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, no more business. We are adjourned.
Bam.
Boom.
Just put you.
Bam. Boom.
Just put you.
We are adjourned.